Thank you, Brother Donald, and my dear brethren and sisters. I'd like to start with our overhead transparency, reminding us of the overall structure of these five altar offerings. And repeating once again, as I shall do, God willing, many times during the course of this week, that we believe that the order which is set out in Leviticus is what we might call a descending order of God manifestation. And in our study yesterday of the so-called burnt offering, we saw that the Hebrew word olah means that which ascended. And the overall principle was that of dedication, in which the offerer indicated that he wished to dedicate himself entirely to his God. I'd like to put up also the summary then, of which we did yesterday, just to remind us of the overall principle which was there. This is the most important of the offerings, for in it the basic idea of God manifestation is set forth, rather than even in the peace or the sin offering. The whole animal was burnt. Now, I want to stop at that point because as a result of several people coming and asking me yesterday where did this word katar fit in, it was obvious I must have skipped over that a little quicker than I should have. If you've got Leviticus open there, just look back at chapter 1 and at verse 9, also repeated in verse 15 and also in verse 17. Now, I'll see if I can make this as clear and as concise as I can. The name of the offering was olah. It actually means to ascend, to go up. The word itself is used in other places apart from the offerings, such as the ascent into Solomon's house. We also mentioned the idea of the regurgitation of the food. So it means that which goes up. But then in verse 9 and in verse 15 and in verse 17, we have there the word burn. Take verse 9. His inwards and his legs shall he wash in water, and the priest shall burn. Now, this is another word, and this is the word katar, which we have there. The whole animal was burned. Now, the import of that word, and we might just slip the next transparency on, and then just come back and we'll finish off our comment. Obviously, I didn't make this quite clear enough. And might I suggest, brethren and sisters, in all sincerity, that a colouring in exercise is extremely valuable if you just get your concordance out and colour in these different words. On here we've got two words, katar and saraph. Forget saraph for the moment. That doesn't come up until the sin offering. That word translated burn means to destroy and to consume. And of course that's appropriate, isn't it, with all the things associated with sin. But now this word katar, the Strong's number up the top there is 6999 if you want to follow it through. It actually means to offer an odour, to burn as incense, to give a scent, and I think that might have been the trap, because I said that olah means to ascend and katar means ascend. See, if you say it quickly, it can sound the same. Must have sounded the same because I didn't see anybody smile. You see, there is a gap between to give a scent. So the purpose there of the burnt offering was to send up a sweet aroma to Yahweh. Hence, the definition can also mean to be fragrant. And Rotherham translates it as to make a perfume of. So the burning of flesh on the altar was not primarily to destroy it. That was just incidental. That was the only way that this fragrance, this odour could ascend, was for a fire to be there. The fire destroyed something, but that was not the principal purpose. You might remember I said that in lighting a candle, for example, you very effectively destroy the candle, but that's not what you're trying to do. You're trying to produce light. Hence, with the olah, the ascending sacrifice, the principal purpose is to send up a katar, a sweet fragrance. So the burning of flesh on the altar was not primarily to destroy, but to produce sweet savour unto Yahweh. I hope that might clarify that point, and if you are able to go through some time and do this colouring in, and eventually also that word saraph a little later on, you'll find it extremely helpful. I mean, on this page of my Bible, I've got a fair bit of marking there, but I could turn to some pages where perhaps there's no marking at all, and I can see by the colouring in here, there's the word peace offering, there's the word burnt, and there are some talks I can give without any marking on the page at all, maybe without any notes, just from the colouring in. And I'll perhaps give an illustration of that. I'm not going to do it that way, mind you. But when we come to the trespass offering, numbers 5 and 6, purely from the colouring in on the page, it is possible to see the order in which the offerings were made, and that of itself teaches us the story. Now, at this stage, we're just looking at the offerings in their own right, and we can go back to that other one. As the week progresses, God willing, we're going to see the importance of the order in which these were offered. Sometimes an offering might have just been made in its own right, but generally they were put together in a particular combination, and it was the combination that really taught the lesson. So just to complete our very quick review of yesterday, picking it up from, it looks like about the second paragraph there, the whole animal was burnt, that is katard, caused to ascend as a fragrance upon the altar of Olah, if we were going to be specific. And everything ascended to Yahweh. The offerer was conscious in a general way of failure and that he was a sinner. Thus there was the need for blood shedding, or shedding of blood, I think it says there. However, it was not consciousness of sin that was uppermost in his mind, but an earnest desire to serve God to the limit of his powers. Hence, that which went on the altar was the head, the fat, the flesh, representing perhaps the intellect, the heart and the soul of man, the whole of his physical powers, and all were pledged to God in a spirit of total dedication to his service. And I don't think we need to read the remaining part of that for our summary. So as we've said then, prior to the law of Moses, and perhaps just momentarily, can we just go back to our first one there again, just to remind ourselves of what we're saying. The first three offerings here, the burnt, the meal, and the peace, were all voluntary offerings. They were all in existence before the law. And someone might well say then, that what provision did God make for the forgiveness of sin? Well, we saw it even in the burnt offering itself, where in Leviticus chapter 1 and at verse 4, the offerer shall press his hand down firmly upon the head of the animal, and it shall be accepted for him to make atonement for him. So you see, prior to the law, the burnt offering was principally to signify dedication, but you can't dedicate your life to God unless you're prepared to cut off those things which offend. And that's what Paul taught in Ephesians, didn't he, when he said, there must be a putting off of the old man and a putting on of the new man. Brother Carter expresses in his book, he says, it's not so much a putting off and a putting on, but rather a putting off by a putting on. So if we're going to put positive things into our mind, that will of itself displace the negative things. So if our attitude to God is seen in this principal offering, the burnt offering, I want to dedicate my life to God, then of course it means that we're going to be in the process putting off the old man. So in the so-called burnt offering, the Olah, the principal lesson was dedication, but atonement was actually built into it as a secondary feature. At the time of the law, God introduced two compulsory offerings, the sin and the trespass, and we'll deal with those, God willing, in due course. Thank you for that. I think we can... just leave that for a moment. We might have a look at there. Incidentally, and I know some of you are saying, I don't know what he's pointing at there. After all the rather rude things I said about Adrian last night, he is in the process of producing this very attractive, colourful one, and he hopes tonight to have, I think what you call an acetate, we just call them film. And God willing, tomorrow, Adrian has said we will have a nice, colourful one like this, which will be easier to read. I know what all of you think. I can see it in your faces. Oh, how can we get a copy? Well, there's the next challenge, Adrian. But actually, he plans to do even better than that, because here is a very, very detailed description of those offerings, and Adrian has got a photocopy of that, and by the end of the week, he says, we will be able to get that. That one really sets out the process similar to there, but under the heading significance, it's got what you will see on each of the summaries that we put up. So the summary for the burnt offering, which we've just read, is there. A little later, the summary of the meal offering will be here. So I do think that it's possible to get that. So if you're not able to copy down all of the things there, it does seem as though it may be possible, perhaps, that by the end of the week, some of this material may be available. So you see, I haven't really committed myself, but perhaps I've committed Adrian. Well, once again, as yesterday, I pointed out the order in which we want to deal with our studies, and we'll follow this order every day, is to first of all say what was offered, then secondly how it was offered, and then of course most importantly why it was offered. You'll notice on the chart there, in this column here, that it shows to us there were essentially three different options. In fact, it's even more than that. And the beauty of this particular offering is that God said to the offerer, I'm going to give you a whole range of options from which you can choose. Because to start with, we notice that the Hebrew word, I think it's tucked away on that left-hand column there, isn't it? Well, it's not, but by this stage you probably remember it from the other day. The Hebrew word is minka. The word minka actually means a gift. I'll read you Strong's definition. It means literally a donation, a gift, or a tribute. In the context of the law, the minka related to grain offerings as distinct from animal offerings. As a sacrifice, it was something given to God of a man's own bounty, of that which was of greatest value to man as a means of livelihood. In fact, we can go further than that. And during the course of my remarks, every now and again I'll say, look, this is important, which means that because we can't remember everything a speaker says, these are the things we must remember. The principal feature of this offering, as far as its preparation was concerned, was this. God gave certain things to man. Man took those things, worked on them, lovingly prepared them, and then gave back to God something that God had already given him in the first place, but he had done something with it to give it back to God as a gift of appreciation. Some of us might think that the minka, the meal offering, was just one of the lighter ones. You know, nothing about forgiveness of sins, nothing about dedication, nothing about fellowship, nothing about forgiveness of trespasses. We might think it was perhaps, as I could say, a lighter one. I think that when I've done these studies before, that at the end of the week, if we've asked people which particular study or which particular offering seemed the most impressive, very often people say the meal offering. Partly because we can see its direct application in our lives today. So all of the ingredients found here in chapter 2 are things that God had given. The grain that had come forth from the ground. And so what God says is, yes, I've given you that grain. Now, you can work on that in a whole number of different ways. To put it so simply that it almost might seem too simple, what God is saying is, you prepare that any way you like. Because if you like it, I'm going to like it. Now, think of it, brethren and sisters. Isn't that the absolute ideal gift? If you wish to give a present to somebody for some particular celebration, don't you just go and think, now, what is it that they would like? And if you were able to go somewhere, or better still, make something with your hands and say, I know they're going to like this, and I'm thoroughly enjoying doing this, so that both when the receiver and the giver get great joy from it, then that is absolutely the ideal gift. You know, brethren and sisters, that's exactly what Moses is being told here when Yahweh instructs him in the way in which the meal offering should be prepared. So consequently, in its simplest form, what you can see on the chart there is that the first three verses speak about the presentation of fine flour in a certain way. And we'll come back in a moment and develop these thoughts. But you know, fine flour was the very, very, very best of the grain. It was the very best. A lot of effort had gone into producing the finest of the flour. So you see, the offerer is presenting the best. The next section in verses 4 to 12, that says 4 to 7 there. That's interesting. Well, I guess you can make the break point at different sections because, as I said, they are very, very general, and you'll find this is even subdivided again. My Bible marking says 4 to 12. When I drew that chart up, for some reason, I put it 4 to 7 and then 14 to 16. Well, that's interesting, that chart. Adrian, I'm not sure how that's going to turn out when we... excuse us just for a minute. Yes, we need to look at that, don't we? All right. Well, that's today's. Last night it was building bridges, but today it's... So we'll turn the transparency off for a moment and I'll work from my notes. They are printed and they're in colour and I should have it right. Having said all that, there are, of course, so many subdivisions here that it is possible to make the breaks at different points. But the general break I've made is this. Fine flour, verses 1 to 3. Unleavened cakes in verses 4 to 12. And then the parched ears of the first fruits constitute the remainder of that chapter down to verse 16. So when we say what was offered, that's the general coverage of it all. Now, how was it offered? Well, let's try to pick up some of these thoughts by looking first of all at the fine flour. And we'll spend most of our time looking at the way in which it's described here in these first three verses. And then really, by extension, the same idea applies in the other applications. So first of all then, we are told in verse 1 that when any will offer, the English says a meat offering. I think by this stage we all know that that word is rather misleading. Doubtless back in the days when King James asked them to translate the Authorized Version, the word meat just meant food in a general sense. Well, that's trying to explain it away for them. But whether it's meat offering or meal offering or food offering still doesn't truly represent what the Hebrew word was, although it may describe in a sense the various ingredients that were in the sacrifice. The word for meat offering, the one Hebrew word, is actually minka. So the word minka we've defined earlier as being a gift or a tribute. And in the context here, we're going to see that God gives something to man, man works on it, and presents it back lovingly to God as a gift. Consequently, the one word that we sometimes use to describe this offering is consecration. If dedication was the burnt offering, then the word consecration, consecrating the work of our hands, may be the one word which would describe all of the minka. So when any will offer a minka unto Yahweh, his offering shall be of fine flour. So the fine flour represents the fruits of God's blessing on man. The fineness indicates that only the very best is good enough to be given to God. Now, I said a little earlier that in offering this, the offerer was given a whole range of choices. And God has said, in effect, look, here's a wide range of choices. I would be delighted with any one of those. You pick the one that you like, and if you like it, I will like it. Just one thing, it's got to be perfect. Remember yesterday? Same thing. It's got to be perfect. And of course, once again, it's reminding us that no one ever kept the law perfectly. The one man who did was even himself cursed by it. So again, it's got to be our aim in life. And I think perhaps, maybe, brethren and sisters, if I'm able to get through this talk and do it reasonably well, that you might see one of the reasons why perhaps this study sometimes appeals to people even more than the others, because it's so practical. What it's telling us is that in any of our service to God, we've got to aim to do the very best. No excuses. Yes, God knows our deficiency. He knows the difficulties. But the aim in our mind should always be to aim for perfection. Because if we aim for anything less than perfection, we will achieve correspondingly less. And so, yes, Yahweh says, I'd love a gift, but it's got to be the very, very best that you can give me. And so the offerer didn't do this just because he had to. He did it because he wanted to. Do we go to the meetings? Do we perform our ecclesial duties because we do it? Because we love doing it? Do you like doing hall cleaning? Do you like doing all those things? Giving out leaflets in bad weather? Do you love doing all those things? Well, I mean, we're all fairly normal people, and I know how I feel sometimes about some of those things. Look down the list of hall cleaning and hope that the others in the roster have done all the hard ones and I get the easy ones. Well, I don't think that's totally true. But you know what we're saying? Are we prepared really to say, look, I want to give of my very best? And so that's what he's saying here with the fine flour. It's got to be the very best. But not only that, he's told in verse 1 again, that he sure shall pour oil upon it. Now, what's the purpose of pouring oil upon it? Well, let's take a couple of references from the New Testament, which I think will help us understand the significance of that. Let's go over to Hebrews. Hebrews chapter 1. Part of the section where it speaks about the Lord Jesus Christ being better than the angels. And in the context of Hebrews chapter 1, the apostle brings before our attention a number of Old Testament passages to prove that Christ is superior to the angels in God's plan of reconciliation. And in that context, therefore, in verse 9, we have this quotation which says, "Thou hast loved righteousness and hated iniquity. Therefore God, even thy God, hath anointed thee with the oil of gladness above thy fellows." He has anointed thee with the oil of gladness above thy fellows. Now the Lord Jesus Christ had a work to do, an offering. Yes, he embodied all of those offerings, very definitely the minchah. He was anointed with the oil of gladness. Now just notice terms like gladness and joy. Obviously, we're not going to look up all of the references, but so let's go back to the 2 Corinthians, at chapter 9. And notice how the Apostle Paul there brings out the same idea of the joy that is to be associated with our work in the truth. 2 Corinthians chapter 9 and verse 7. And I suppose it would be appropriate, therefore, to read the corresponding verse so we can just see what he's saying. 2 Corinthians 9, say, picking it up from verse 6. "But this I say, he which soweth sparingly shall reap also sparingly, and he which soweth bountifully shall reap also bountifully. Every man according as he purposeth in his heart, so let him give, not grudgingly or of necessity, for God loveth a cheerful giver." You know, if you wanted to put one little caption over the meal offering, it could be that. God loveth a cheerful giver. We're going to give back to God the finest of the flour, so that's the best of our efforts. We're going to pour upon it the oil of joy and gladness, for God loveth a cheerful giver. You can look up your concordance and find other New Testament references. In John chapter 17, the Lord mentioned that many times, where the idea of oil is associated with the wonderful joy of the truth. So we're not here this week because we've got to be here. We're here because we want to be here. And the service that we want to give to God is the best because, and again, in saying this, it almost sounds a little bit too simplistic, but aren't we trying to prepare a gift to give to our very, very best friend? It sounds strange to talk about God like that, but we mean that, don't we? And therefore we give to him of our best, and we do it not grudgingly, but we do it cheerfully and with gladness. So going back then to Leviticus chapter 2, we've seen the second of the three essential features which are expressed to us in this opening verse. Leviticus 2 and verse 1, the first feature of course was the fine flour. Now we're told that he is to pour oil upon it. And this signifies the influence of the Spirit word and the true joy that it brings through sanctification of the truth. Anything so given to God must be motivated by joy. And in my margin here I've got other references as well, like Psalm 100 verse 2 and others. Now the third ingredient of the three. And put frankincense thereon. Frankincense, of course, was an element of the incense, and most of us would be well aware of the fact that it signifies prayer. Perhaps let's take two New Testament references just to give us a little bit of help there. Let's go over to Philippians. Philippians chapter 4. Philippians chapter 4 and verse 6. Be careful for nothing, but in everything by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known unto God. See those terms there? Supplication, prayer, and thanksgiving. Perhaps just slipping over to Timothy, the first of Timothy chapter 4. In the first of Timothy chapter 4, verses 4 and 5. For every creature of God is good, and nothing to be refused, if it be received with thanksgiving. For it is sanctified by the word of God and prayer. Now I think we've looked up quite sufficient references to see the lesson. If we wanted to make a study of each one of these, certainly there could be a whole talk on any one of those ingredients. But look at the three lessons that come to us just from verse 1. It taught us that God wants the best possible service. That was the fine flour. And by the way, if you go through then the other options which are indicated later, things like unleavened cakes, the same principle will come out. So we're just concentrating mainly on this early one. It must be the best possible service. It must be performed with joy. That is the oil that was poured on it. And it must be sanctified by prayer, which of course is the frankincense. Brethren and sisters, I think that's a very good reminder, isn't it? We like the truth to be expressed to us simply. And there it is, beautifully and simply in verse 1. Can we start each day by saying, I'm delighted that it's a new day. I want this day to be a service to God. I'm going to enjoy it, and I'm going to ask for his blessing upon it to the honour of his name. And that really is what life's all about. Why the need for the other offerings then? Well, of course, we realise that whilst we try to the best of our extent to do this, we come short of the glory of God. And therefore in offering, say, a sin offering, we are acknowledging the righteousness of God, that despite all of our efforts, we still don't deserve to be in the kingdom. And obviously, therefore, the other offerings will fill in those things which cater for our deficiencies and ultimately show us the way to fellowship. But this is the real practical one, isn't it? In which the offerer is providing something out of that which God has given him. He's worked on it, and he's given it back to God in a form which both God and he would find a delight. So that as you glance down through those verses, and we don't need to read them again because we've already had them read to us, but you had the option of unleavened cakes, unleavened wafers. I notice in verse 5 it could be bacon in a pan. It could be bacon in a frying pan. It could be baked in an oven. There's all these different combinations. So a wide range, but whatever you do, do it to the best of your ability. And ask God's blessing upon your labours. Now, in verse 2, we read there that he shall bring it to Aaron's sons, the priests, and he shall take thereout his handful of the flour thereof, and of the oil thereof, with all the frankincense thereof, and the priest shall burn. Now here's our word katar again. Remember the katar one that we started with this morning? Here it is again. The priest is going to cause to ascend as a fragrance the memorial of it upon the altar, to be an offering made by fire of a sweet savour unto Yahweh. So the verse is telling us then that there was a handful of fine flour impregnated with oil. It's taken by the priest, but all the frankincense is burnt upon the altar. In other words, all prayer ascends to Yahweh, and of course it went through the priest. So it speaks then about the portion which was burnt on the altar as being the memorial. Now, the memorial had the idea of bringing good works to remembrance. Let's just pick up some thoughts from these next few verses, verses 4 to 13, and I want to come back and say a little bit more about the memorial in just a moment. In verses 4 to 13, and I'll read the summary that I've got here, which might be the best way of doing this. This had to do with unleavened cakes. Now, the offerer can make a choice of the form in which the minkah might be offered. If he prefers cakes rather than fine flour, he can prepare such cakes for the purpose. This can take the form that he likes best as food, so long as it conforms to the restrictions laid down. Four varieties of cakes are listed, by which the flour and oil can be made up for cooking. The ritual of the offerings repeats that of the first form, which we considered. The frankincense finds no mention in this case, but we would understand it is there to be assumed. So we've looked at what was offered, we've looked at how it was offered, and I think we've already started to see why it was offered. Well, let's just have a look at some examples of the minkah in order to see the why. What was the first occurrence in the Bible of a minkah? I don't necessarily want you to call out the answer. If you want to, you can. What was the first occurrence of a minkah being offered in the Bible? Well, it was right back in Genesis chapter 4. And in Genesis chapter 4, in the opening verses, we have two men who were worshippers. We must always remember that. Both Cain and Abel were worshipping God. Because Cain turned out to be a murderer and a bad fellow, we sometimes overlook the fact that it all started with them being two worshippers. One of them worshipped God according to God's requirements. The other did it in a way in which he said, well, God knows my thoughts and God will be satisfied with what I've given. So we read in Genesis chapter 4 that Adam knew his wife Eve, and she conceived and bare Cain and said, I've gotten a man from Yahweh. And she again bare his brother Abel. And Abel was a keeper of sheep, but Cain was a tiller of the ground. And in process of time it came to pass that Cain brought of the fruit of the ground a minkah. So when you go through and colour in the five basic altar offerings and you look up the word minkah, this will be your first occurrence. And here it is, Cain offered a minkah unto Yahweh. Well, what was it that Abel offered? And most people would say, well, that's very simple. We all know what Abel offered. He offered of the firstlings of his flock. Well, was that all he offered? If you read Opus Israel, you'll notice that Brother Thomas, who was always a very, very accurate reader of the Bible, said Abel didn't only just offer the firstlings of his flock, he also offered a minkah. He both dedicated and consecrated his offerings. So in verse 4 we read, and Abel, he also brought of the firstlings of his flock and of the fat thereof, And Yahweh had respect unto Abel and to his Minka. So Abel didn't just offer the firstlings of his flock. He offered the firstlings of his flock and a Minka. And Brother Thomas in Elpis Israel points out there's two reasons for that. One is the simple little word in verse 4 which says also. And Abel, he also, in addition to a Minka, brought the firstlings of his flock. And so in verse 5 we read, but unto Cain and to his Minka he had not respect. And of course we've seen there, right at this early stage, that Abel understood the principles of the atonement. Without the shedding of blood, there can be no remission of sin. They had to acknowledge that they had come short of the glory of God. There had to be an offering of the first fruits of his flock. But Abel didn't want to just leave it there. He also wanted to give of the work of his hands. So he gave of the firstlings of his flock. And Yahweh had respect unto Abel, because Abel's Minka was offered in association with the shedding of the blood. Whereas Cain would have been a typical Judaizer. He was thinking, I will get into the kingdom by my works. And there it was, the first Judaizer, if you like, right back there in the case of Cain. So when you do the exercise, the first references to the Minka are right back here in Genesis chapter 4. I've got some other examples here. I'll just mention them to you because I want to get on to another one, and we've got only just a few minutes left. It was associated with prayer in Psalm 141 and verse 2. Let my prayers ascend before thee as incense, and the lifting up of my hands as the evening sacrifice. Perhaps we better look it up just to get that statement quite correct. Psalm 141 and verse 2. He says, the reason I'm doing this is because you've got to know which word it is. Let my prayer be set forth before thee as incense, and the lifting up of my hands as the evening minka. Now the evening morning sacrifice, of course, was a burnt offering and a meal offering. But in this particular psalm, the psalmist decides to highlight the fact that it was the minka that he had in mind, because he's talking about his prayer and the lifting up of his hands, and there's an incident where it's a minka. I won't look these other ones up, but in Malachi, every time you find the word offering there, it is also a minka. Now, we're saying that in order for the work of our hands to be acceptable, it must be associated, of course, with the acknowledgement that without the shedding of blood, there can be no remission of sin. Can you think of some individual who set out in his life to serve God, but he didn't know that he had to be baptized? Well, I've got in mind Acts chapter 10, Cornelius. Have you ever thought of the fact that the story of Acts chapter 10 is based upon Leviticus chapter 2? Well, it is. And we've got two very good reasons for saying it. As you're turning over to Acts chapter 10, do you remember a little word that I just skipped over and said we'll come back to in a moment? Do you remember that which went on the altar was described as a memorial? Remember the memorial of the offering? The memorial was to bring good works to remembrance. It was to remind God. It was to be a memorial. Well, when we go to Acts chapter 10, we know the story of this great man, Cornelius, and that Peter, of course, was sent down to teach Cornelius that there was something that was missing from his life. Let's just start the story in verse 2. Acts chapter 10, verse 2. Cornelius was a devout man, and one that feared God with all his house, which gave much alms to the people. So he was doing good works. He was giving things to God's people. He saw in a vision, evidently about the ninth hour of the day, an angel of God coming into him and saying unto him, Cornelius. And when he looked on him, he was afraid and said, What is it, Lord? Now listen to what the Lord said. He said unto him, Thy prayers, okay, the incense, thine alms, thy good works, are come up for a memorial before God. Now that's exactly the principle of the meal offering. They've come up for a memorial before God. And he was trying to the best of his ability to do all of the things that were set out there in the meal offering. But that's not the only case. Look down again at verse 31. Perhaps verse 30 to get the flow of the sentence. And Cornelius said, four days ago I was fasting until this hour, and at the ninth hour I prayed in my house, and behold, a man stood before me in bright clothing and said, Cornelius, thy prayer is heard, there's the frankincense, and thine alms are had in remembrance in the sight of God. Remembrance, memorial, the same sort of word. It brings good works to remembrance. So here was a man then that was diligently performing in his life what really was the lesson of the meal offering. But he had to learn something, didn't he? He had to learn that a meal offering of itself was not sufficient, but that he had to be baptized. And of course, we all know the story of what subsequently happened. So Yahweh looked down upon this man, and maybe there are others in society today. We just don't know that Yahweh looks down. And he sees them trying to the limit of their ability to lovingly give back to God something in thankfulness and praise. But they don't know the truth. Now, of course, we've got to be careful here because we don't know the ways of providence. We don't know how they work. The Father may give that person some opportunity. Maybe we should be out there doing it. Whatever the case might be. But this was a classic case of someone wanting to serve God. He was doing all of those things associated with a meal offering. But one thing is yet needful, thou must arise and be baptized. And so those two verses there, I think, are very helpful in our understanding of a New Testament application of one who was performing the principle of a meal offering, even though it couldn't be totally acceptable to God because he had not yet been baptized. And I'll just repeat it. It's in verse 4. Thy prayers, the incense, thine alms, the very fine flour, and all of the things you're doing to the best of your ability, they've come up for a memorial. So they've gone on that altar of incense as a memorial, but without the shedding of blood, there can be no remission of sin. So Cornelius, you've got to be baptized. And I have no doubt that Cornelius willingly and joyfully was baptized to the same extent that he willingly and joyfully gave alms to God's people. And might we say, therefore, that when we come before the table of the Lord on a Sunday, that in the partaking of the bread and the wine, there's a lot of things we can think about there, but there's also an element of the meal offering in that. I'd like to conclude then with just one quote. Let's go back to Psalm 96. I think we've seen our lesson. In fact, we haven't. So let's put it up. It's the last transparency, please, which will be our summary. Here it is. Let's read this and then we'll conclude with Psalm 96. This will be hopefully on that other sheet that I mentioned that we hopefully will get in due course under the heading of significance. The meal offering is the natural sequel to the burnt offering. In the burnt offering, man gave himself to Yahweh, but in the minkah, he gave up his possessions. It was not merely grain, but grain treated in some way by man. He was giving back to God something that God had blessed him with, but upon which he had expended personal labour. Fine flour stood for perfection of service. Oil signified that the works had all to be prompted by God's Spirit and with joy. Frankincense was the symbol of prayer and true spiritual worship, showing that the works were solely to the honour and glory of Yahweh. The meal offering was intended to bring good works to remembrance. Thus, leaven and honey, of which we didn't really make any comment this morning, symbolising fermentation or corruption, were excluded. The salt, of which we made no comment, reminded the offerer of the terms of Yahweh's covenant. A meal offering and a drink offering were part of the evening and morning burnt offering and can represent the bread and the wine of the memorial supper. So with that as a summary, let us just conclude then with reading the words of Psalm 96 and verses 8 and 9. Psalm 96, and this is the very verse from which our theme for the week is taken. Give unto Yahweh the glory due unto his name, bring a minkah. Now our theme for the week is bring an offering and come into his courts. The very word for offering there is minkah. Bring an offering and come into his courts. O worship Yahweh in the beauty of holiness. Fear before him all the earth. So brethren and sisters, may our minkahs this week, to the very best of our ability, follow those principles which we've learned from Leviticus chapter 2 this morning. And may it be that our service, done in the spirit of the word and with great joy, will bring joy to our Heavenly Father, our very best friend, our Father in heaven.